This week on Making Contact.
The main force behind for-profit medical care is Wall Street. Its investors are looking for a way to make money. Nobody but investors benefits from for-profit medicine.
One of the ironies is publicly funded healthcare systems are incredibly good deals. They're way cheaper, way more efficient, way more effective than any private system. And I mean, that is an old and a dead question.
As managed healthcare companies merge and gobble up hospitals, more and more medical decisions are weighed as financial considerations. On this archive edition of Making Contact, which first aired April 1st, 1998, we look at healthcare in the United States. We also present a report on Canada's national healthcare program. I'm Philip Babbage, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. A doctor's visit is no longer a simple matter.
The first question is, can I have a copy of your insurance card? And then that's where the game begins, because you look at the insurance card and you're trying to identify whether the insurance that this patient has is an insurance that your doctor is currently contracted with.
Cheryl Bergevin is an office manager who's in charge of accounts receivable for a medical facility in California. She has 20 years experience in the medical field and knows the intricacies of what she terms the shell game of managed care.
You look at the card, and there are a number of clues on the card, which may be a logo, which may be, it may clearly identify your doctor as contracted. It may say that this is a PPO plan, which is a preferred provider organization plan. It may be a POS plan, which is called a point of service plan, meaning that there are multiple options that the patient can pursue. It may be an HMO plan, which means that they're restricted into what physicians they can go to, and usually they have to go through their primary care physician before they can see any specialists. And then there's also what's called an EPO plan, which is an exclusive provider organization, which is basically a PPO plan with more restrictions than the PPO plan, but less restrictions than, say, an HMO plan. Sometimes, unfortunately, the patient will show up and they have a card that, say, is One Health Plan POS, and your doctor is contracted with One Health Plan PPO, but not with One Health Plan POS. And so you, at that point, have to inform the patient that the doctor's not contracted with that insurance, that you would be more than happy to see them, but that their insurance would be null and void and that they would have to pay for their visit at the time. Patients generally get very upset by this, and rightfully so. The patient is caught in the middle, and it's quite frustrating for them.
Bergevin views herself as a patient advocate. She's careful to match a patient's medical information with guidelines that insurance firms and managed care companies use to approve treatment.
Many of the companies out there have basically a template that they fill out that's in a database that is programmed to say that for this specific surgical procedure, these are the indicators that are needed or the care that needs to have been provided so that this surgery can be authorized. In the case of, say, a hysterectomy, there needs to be so many months of bleeding. There needs to be a trial of different medications taken place so that you need to do everything you possibly can to treat this patient without ultimately ending up having to do surgery. So when you call the insurance company, you get a feel for what each individual insurance company needs, and basically you know what questions they're going to ask and what answers. It could be the same answer given two different ways. One will get your insurance authorized, the other will not get your insurance authorized. So you kind of learn how to phrase things that are going to get the job accomplished, and what you want accomplished is good patient care, good medical care provided to the patient in a timely fashion.
This arrangement has skewed the patient-physician relationship, according to Dr. Gerard Nam, an obstetrician and gynecologist.
Clearly, you know, the sorts of relationship that physicians have with their patients are generally very well-founded, and the physician has to engender some level of trust with regard to their patients in order to be able to accomplish the, you know, their usual sorts of tasks. And it's very daunting when faced with this sort of predicament, because you have seen, examined, recommended to a patient a certain course of action, generally for very, very specific and good reason. And then an insurance clerk will simply deny the sort of thing that you have asked for. And then you're faced with having to explain to a patient why it is that something that is clearly indicated in your best judgment is now being denied by an institution that they regard, at least the patient I'm speaking of, as having some sort of medical knowledge. In other words, what they may come back and think, depending on their level of sophistication, education, et cetera, is, well, doctor, you know, if you're recommending this and you're right, how could it be that an insurance company would deny my having it? Doesn't that mean that you're wrong? Doesn't it mean that you've made a bad judgment? Doesn't it mean, doctor, that you are clearly not very competent?
NAM recently completed a manuscript documenting several case studies where managed care companies with restrictive treatment policies jeopardized the health of some of his patients. Marie Lamadue, a 38-year-old mother of two, was having difficulty conceiving another child. At the time, she was experiencing heavy bleeding and extreme discomfort.
After several different exams and treatments that failed, my health was worsening at the same time. We weren't able to discover what exactly was causing the problem. It was a lot of troubleshooting. And we finally, after months of being in pain and heavy bleeding or no bleeding at all, Dr. Nam opted for an ultrasound to be done, and thus we located a fibroid tumor there, a rather large one that was causing the problem. So he gave me the decision as to whether to go on and do further testing on this, or he advised me that in order to be completely comfortable and out of pain and with no more complications, opt for a hysterectomy. So I decided to go that route because I had spent a couple of years with all kinds of terrible health problems, missing work, depression because of it, lots of pain and lots of heavy bleeding, and I was more than happy to have this operation done. So when he submitted the paperwork to my PPO, which was Lifeguard at the time, Lifeguard immediately came back and denied the request, which upset both the doctor and I, because I was ready and willing and wanting to do this, and all the past history indicated that this was necessary. They, in turn, wanted more testing done. For about 2 weeks, I was sitting on phone lines for hours at a time. I was leaving messages and not getting calls back, and there were excuses given that not enough information was provided by the doctor when he had my whole they had my whole file. I could never get a doctor on the phone. The head nurse would say, well, you know, if you didn't get past that point, we have a point system here, and after asking you all these questions, you're still denied a request to have this operation done. And it was excruciatingly upsetting to me.
Eventually, Lamadue got approval for her hysterectomy. Another one of Dr. Naim's patients wasn't so lucky. She was unable to carry a pregnancy to full term because her immune system was rejecting the fetus, and she needed treatment to save her current pregnancy. Gerard Nam.
After coming to a very well-founded conclusion as to what sorts of treatments might be effective in preventing her from miscarrying her current pregnancy, her insurance company just simply refused to allow her to be treated. When I say refused, I mean they refused to allow her to receive the drugs that were necessary to stop her from her rejecting her pregnancy effectively. And they said that they were planning to review the case in the future and that they would convene a meeting at their review board 2 to 3 weeks hence. And when I informed them that that would be much too late to salvage the current pregnancy, they seemed to have very little regard for that. And as a result of their failure to allow proper treatment of their patient, the fetus did die. And in 17 weeks of pregnancy, in the mid-second trimester, this woman, unfortunately, was carrying a dead fetus. Now, that in and of itself is, you know, obviously an emotionally traumatic event. But it also portends some potentially serious medical problems that can also ensue as a result of the death of the fetus within the womb. And so it needed to be evacuated. It needed to come out. And despite the fact that the insurance company was clearly responsible for the fact that this fetus had died, they refused to allow her to have an evacuation procedure and insisted that she go to an abortion clinic effectively and have the procedure done in a mill type setting with no anesthesia. Ultimately, what happened was that she went to this abortion clinic, was just so disgusted with the whole thing that she walked out. Ultimately, her insurance company in this situation, once she began to show signs of disseminated intravascular coagulation, which is a life-threatening disorder, said that they would make a one-time exception.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This radio program can be heard across North America, in South Africa, and on the Internet. You can also hear us on Radio for Peace International Shortwave. If you want more information about the subject of this week's show, call the National Radio Project. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts, 800-529-5736. We also welcome comments and suggestions for future programs.
Through strikes and patient advocacy programs, some healthcare workers have been struggling for reform of the managed care system. Recently, the Service Employees International Union formed a partnership with Kaiser Permanente, the largest managed care company in the United States. According to the SEIU's Sal Rosselli, who helped establish the partnership, this deal will enable healthcare workers to play a bigger role in setting policies at Kaiser facilities. As an example, SEIU members are working with the company as it opens a new hospital.
We now have committees going on with a lot of rank-and-file leaders in nursing and other segments of the hospital that are jointly deciding on how to open that hospital, including the systems of patient care, and most significantly, including participation and decision-making in clinical outcome improvements, which, to my knowledge, no nurses union or other healthcare workers union in the country has accomplished through collective bargaining.
Other attempts have been made to regulate managed care, but given the financial and political strength of HMOs and insurance companies, legislation that would rein in these institutions has fallen short. Steffi Woolhandler is a physician and teaches at Harvard Medical School. She's also a spokesperson for Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, an organization that advocates a single-payer healthcare system in the United States.
I don't feel that regulation per se is going to solve the problems of profit-driven care. I am really an abolitionist. I think we have to abolish profit-driven care and go toward a universal healthcare system that's based on charity, public service, and essentially nonprofit institutions. So there is a lot of move in state legislators and even nationally to try to regulate the worst abuses of managed care, but I don't see much result likely to come from that. It's much more important for people to understand that the drive for profits is what's wrong with the healthcare system. And in order to fix the healthcare system, we have to eliminate that drive for profits. Now, that's less radical than it sounds because, in fact, all the countries of Western Europe and Canada as well have said we don't think healthcare is an appropriate place for profit-making corporations. Those are all capitalist countries. They have profit-making in other fields, but they feel that people in those countries believe that when it comes to healthcare, when you're talking about sick and vulnerable human beings, the profit ethic really doesn't have a place.
Managed care companies argue that privatizing the health industry will lead to more efficient service for patients, since companies will be forced to compete against each other for business. But this reasoning, according to Woolhandler, is suspect.
The main force behind for-profit medical care is Wall Street. Its investors are looking for a way to make money. And if you have an industry that's been run on a nonprofit basis, you know, you can often, and you're willing to go in and operate for profit to act as ruthlessly as you need to in order to extract profits, often there's big profits to be made. So, in fact, the driving force was that there was money to be made by transforming healthcare from a public service into a commodity. Nobody but investors benefits from for-profit medicine. It's not better for the nurses. In fact, the for-profit hospitals hire fewer nurses and other clinical personnel. It's not better for the patients. There's absolutely no study that's ever found a higher quality of care in a for-profit setting. It's not better for taxpayers and individual policyholders because the prices, the costs at for-profit hospitals are actually somewhat higher than in the nonprofit sector. The only people who benefit are, in fact, the investors, and as you know, it's just a tiny proportion of people.
Wohlhandler adds that there are cozy institutional relationships among health maintenance organizations, HMOs, and insurance companies.
The major for-profit HMOs in this country are owned by the for-profit insurance industry. There's not a separation between HMOs and insurance companies other than name. So the largest owners of HMOs in this country are, for instance, Aetna and Prudential, New York Life, Cigna. So in fact, when we're talking about HMOs, we're just talking about a reincarnation of the old for-profit insurance industry.
The managed care system, according to healthcare workers and physicians, has also stifled free speech in the workplace. In some cases, private hospitals and insurers have forbidden doctors and nurses to share all available information with their patients. Also, those who speak out publicly about such matters often suffer reprisals from their employers or the managed care companies they do business with. Dr. Gerard Nam says the courts have found these so-called gag rules unconstitutional, but in many cases are still effectively in place.
There are physicians who have realized in the course of practicing that to sit down with a patient and to list, you know, the five or six different treatment options available to them and explain them all and then say, by the way, you know, item 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 is not available to you with your insurance carrier, so you have to go with item number 1, does not engender goodwill with anybody. And it could be setting them up for a long and protracted fight with an insurance company or insurance company executives to try and get approval for something that they've recommended to a patient when, in fact, they know it's going to take huge amounts of time out of their day, huge amount of resource allocation on their part. And after a while, after you've fought these battles, you know, 10 or 20 or 100 times, you begin to realize as a practitioner, it's not worth it because you're not going to get that treatment approved anyway. So what's the point of even mentioning it?
Some healthcare reformers in the United States are arguing for a government-run universal coverage plan, one that would guarantee medical services without the complications and profits of the current system. To explore this option, correspondents Karen Van Buren and Ron Forthoffer took a look at Canada's national healthcare system.
You know, there's a joke that says the definition of a Canadian is an American with a healthcare system and no gun. It's terribly important to realize that for the people who went through the Depression, who saw their livelihood evaporate, the existence of social programs are a key element of the Canadian identity.
Universal coverage?
No copays.
No deductibles?
Total portability?
Choice of physician?
Long-term care.
Mental health care?
No mountains of paperwork.
Canada's got it all, and for 10% of gross domestic product. That's compared with 14% and rising in the United States, where around 42 million people have no health coverage whatsoever. And an estimated 80 million would be financially ruined by a major health problem.
I just hear it's socialist.
It's kind of socialistic, isn't it?
What Canada doesn't have is socialized medicine in the full sense. It's not like Britain, where the doctors are all salaried and work for the state, though there are some rural doctors who are on a salary. In Canada, doctors are not government employees. They simply bill a single public insurance fund, which is why the Canadian system is often referred to as a single-payer system. Doctors do, however, negotiate their fees with the government.
That's very different from the United States, where physicians find themselves swimming in a sea of paperwork and billing any of 1,500 private insurers. The federal government in Canada apportions some funding, but most is raised by the provinces through taxes.
Still, there are regional variations in how the provinces raise their health care dollars. You may or may not have to pay a health insurance premium in addition to the payroll tax paid by your employer. Each province administers its own health plan. There are regional variations in what's covered, but all provinces run plans in accordance with the principles set out in the Canada Health Act of 1971.
Canadians call their health care system Medicare. Medicare had small beginnings in the early 1960s in the province of Saskatchewan. The progressive government of the time, led by Premier Tommy Douglas, introduced a state-funded program of medical insurance which met with vigorous opposition from the medical profession.
The province's physicians waged a vicious propaganda campaign against public health insurance, which culminated in a doctor's strike. But faced with hostile public opinion and a legion of British doctors who were flown in to help break the strike, it was a battle Saskatchewan's doctors were doomed to lose. And it wasn't too long before other Canadian provinces were introducing similar public health insurance plans. John Iles, McMaster University professor.
Why did it spread across Canada? Largely because I think we have a more corporatist and collective ideal than the U.S. Our philosophy is not freedom and liberty, but good government is in the Canadian Constitution. And I think this, again, is a reason why it spread from one province across the country. And also, I think it spread because of that post-war welfare ethos that was current in Europe and also Canada.
Call me a doctor if you want. I'll get the cure out to be admitted.
Nearly 40 years on, and the welfare ethos has given way to a tough fiscal conservatism. But Ontario's public relations director, Paul Kilbertus, says Canadians are still wedded to their single-payer system.
What we have, I think, is overwhelming public support. It's truly remarkable that the Medicare system in Canada is supported by over 90% of the population, by far the most popular government program in this country.
My healthcare system is rather good. I like how it takes care of me. I like how it takes care of everybody. Nobody really has to go without. If it's an emergency, we all get taken care of, and we don't have the massive long-term financial effects that I've heard a lot of people in America have to deal with.
Allison, a campground worker from British Columbia, who grew up with Medicare and can't imagine life without it. Listen to what the U.S. media often have to say about Canadians and their healthcare system, however, and you might be led to believe most Canadians are fed up with a system that costs too much and delivers too little. Rick Hudson, a medical consultant for the Ministry of Health in British Columbia, contests that myth shrouds reality on matters such as Canada's waiting lists.
We're aware of the propaganda that the opponents of the Canadian system put out in the United States, and we would make the kind of the following comments. If you need hip surgery and you're in a waiting list that's been properly managed, in other words, the most acute people go to the top of the list, then we would take that any day over 15% of our population not having access to a waiting list. We ration on the basis of your need and your ability to wait. You ration on your basis of your ability to pay. But every 5 years, we have to go through the whole thing about why we don't have user fees. Wouldn't it be good for people just to pay a little bit, blah, blah, blah? And it's like the answer is no, we've studied that. When they had user fees in Saskatchewan for a brief period under a conservative administration, the people who stopped using the healthcare system were the poor and the elderly. So for us, the issue of copayment at point of service is a dead issue. We don't want to talk about it, and we'll treat it as a zombie every time it gets up.
Certainly there's a neoconservative wave sweeping across Canada that wants to scale down social programs and sees healthcare as a prime target for privatization.
We had largely until 4 or 5 years ago, and I largely speak of the Ontario experience, an open-ended system which led to our costs rising in line with yours. The hospitals are actually receiving budget reductions. They are being capped in terms of what they can spend. There is a performance appraisal of the hospital, so how well are they doing? And what has happened over the past few years here is that if you do really well, then your reduction is reduced.
In focusing more closely on the issue of who delivers care and how, Canadian policymakers are also beginning to take a serious look at the love affair modern medicine has with the technological fix, a love affair that is also driving up U.S. healthcare costs. There's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day. We're also, I think, trying to move away from seeing healthcare as hospital care. There's an attempt to engage the social determinants of health, which you may be familiar with, looking at the importance of lifestyle, of income, of education, and so on, an attempt, therefore, to see health as wellness.
Integrating services, focusing on wellness. There's a lot of tinkering with the system, but with health and social welfare programs being the first to come under the Budget Cutters Acts, are any Canadian politicians talking seriously about abandoning Canada's single-payer health care?
One of the ironies is, as Che Guevara said, can I help it if reality is Marxist, that, you know, publicly funded healthcare systems are incredibly good deals. You know, I mean, they're way cheaper, way more efficient, way more effective than any private system. And, I mean, that is an old and a dead question.
Although the ranks of the uninsured and underinsured continue to swell in the U.S., there is little or no talk within the Washington Beltway of single-payer as a solution to the healthcare crisis. The public, too, has been primed by a corporate media to balk at talk of healthcare reform when coupled with the words government and taxes.
John Iles claims advocates of a single-payer system for the U.S. are faced with bringing about a quantum shift in thinking. Critics say the American system costs too much, covers too few, and delivers too little, and it's getting worse all the time. Iles says Americans need firstly to believe that healthcare is a right within any society that truly values its citizens.
I think it's the way you frame the arguments. Yes, I think you will be accused of trying to introduce socialistic medicine, and the physicians will be certainly up in arms against that. However, to see, I think, universal provision of health care as a right of citizens, I think, is probably the way to go.
For Making Contact, I'm Karen Van Vuren.
And I'm Ron Forthover.
That's it for this archive edition of Making Contact, a look at managed care and alternative choices for health services. This program first aired April 1st, 1998. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Rob Cohen for recorded portions and editorial assistance. We have production assistance from Eric Kamako. Laura Labate is our managing director, Peggy Law's executive director. Our production assistant is Shireen Miraji. Norman Solomon is senior advisor. Our national producer is David Barsamian. And I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babich. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.